You are listening to On the Daily, the RotoViz Daily Fantasy Sports Podcast, powered by RotoViz Radio.
Hey everyone, I'm Matt Friedman, Matt F. the Oracle of the Action Network and RotoViz. Welcome to the April 21st, 2018 RotoViz Live edition of On the Daily. I'm joined by Dr. Nick Giffen, an owner of RotoViz, a PhD in mathematics, a three-time qualifier for the DraftKings NASCAR main event, and one of the best NASCAR DFS players in the world. You can follow him on Twitter at RotoDoc. Nickelodeous, you can see here that I am not in my normal environment. I am in Texas recording this using a hotspot as my internet. So what could go wrong? How are you doing?
Exactly. What could go wrong? We've never had anything go wrong recording these podcasts before. So it's early here in Vegas. I got up and made some coffee but we're ready to go. Richmond is going to be a fun race, I think. It tends to be a bit of a action-less race for the Action Network article. You can bet on the picks there because I think it's actually a really good week for the model and the sim scores because it's an actionless race. But there's always action to be had over at the Action Network and at RotoViz. So cool article and cool models this week. I'm pretty excited for Richmond because well, one thing we didn't talk about in the midweek podcast is the predictability of the model. It is 0.633 this weekend. So very good. So
pretty good.
Yeah. Put your faith in the model this weekend.
You know, one thing that you didn't mention while you were going on your little action rant over there, you know, one of the nicknames for the Richmond Raceway?
What would it be?
Action Track.
That's right.
That's right. So, you know, it's going to be a good race. Okay, so we're recording this on Saturday morning. The race is later tonight, so it's the first night race of the year. Qualifying and practice were yesterday. Based on what you saw in practice and qualifying specifically, like any kind of like big picture things that we should be aware of before we get into stuff?
Yeah, I think there's one thing we really want to talk about. And a lot of good drivers ended up qualifying towards the back. Kyle Busch was saving a little bit in the opening session and didn't realize he saved a little too much, right? He was trying to save tires for rounds two and round three of qualifying. Problem is he didn't get into round two of qualifying because he saved a little too much. So he's starting 32nd. You got Brad Keselowski starting 28th. You got Almirola 25th, Suarez 26th. A lot of big names back there. Almendinger 33rd, for example. I mean, he's not necessarily a big name, but he's bigger than the Joe Dirt cheap names. So definitely an interesting qualifying session. But I wanted to compare Kyle Busch this week to Kevin Harvick last week. Last week, Kevin Harvick started dead last, 39th, and was 10,500. There's a couple differences between Harvick last week and Kyle Busch this week that I think we want to be aware of. So, again, last week, Harvick started 39th, dead last. This week, and Kyle Busch starts only 32nd out of 38 cars, so not dead last. And, you know, that does make a little bit of a difference. He can only, you know, go from 32nd to first instead of 39th to first in terms of possible place differential potential. Also, this track is more predictable, and starting position matters more here than it does at Bristol, where wrecks happen all the time and crazy things can happen all the time. That played a little bit to Harvick's advantage in terms of place differential gain. The thing that was a disadvantage for Harvick and at Bristol versus Kyle Busch here is the DNF rate is much higher at Bristol. So there was always also a very good chance of Harvick, crashing out or having some kind of problem at Bristol. Whereas this weekend at Richmond, it's much less likely that Kyle Busch will encounter major problems. The DNF rate we said on average is somewhere between 9% and 13%. If you think the fall and spring races are different at Richmond, then maybe it's around 10% this weekend. So that does help Kyle Busch, but the model only gives him a projected finish of 13.3. The median finish for him is 9.5. Obviously, the median higher than the mean because of the possibility for DNF. But if he makes it all the way up to that 9.5 finish 50% of the time, he still might not even be in the winning lineup just because he's $11,400. You'd probably need him to grab some fastest laps or laps led. So I don't think he's a slam dunk this weekend in GPPs.
We talked about this some on the midweek show, but I think it would be good to recap it here just so we can kind of have that as a base moving forward for the questions. What are the big picture metrics that you were looking at this weekend to judge how we might evaluate these drivers?
Yeah, big picture. Starting position actually is one of the most important stats in the model. So that goes in there, and that's a pretty easy metric to judge. Long run speed, so 10-lap average if you have that. There was also, of course, 20-lap speeds posted on Fox, and not as many drivers ran 20 laps, so it's a little bit harder to judge because, you know, we only have 10 20-lap times that Fox posted on TV. And so a little bit harder to judge, but we do know, at least from the 20-lap times, Kevin Harvick has an amazing car this weekend. You know, he was over a tenth, or he was exactly a tenth of a second quicker per lap over those 20 laps than the second place driver there. And then the other metrics we want to look at is quality pass percentage at Richmond in the past. So drivers past 6 or 8 Richmond races, what has been their quality pass percentage at Richmond? And that's because passing's hard at Richmond. It's a short, flat track. And if you can make passes, that's much better, especially making passes inside the top 15, which is what quality pass percentage is. It's the percentage of passes you make that are inside the top 15. So those are what we really want to look at. And then year-to-date performance as well. Obviously, we've now got 8 races under our belt, 7 non-restrictor plate races. So we're really starting to build a sample size here.
All right, so a number of the questions that we have relate to Kyle Busch. So I think if we just sort of like knock Kyle Busch out of the way so we can get to the rest of the show, that would be a good thing to do. Like what, in terms of like a single entry or, you know, maybe like 3 max entry versus multi-entry GPPs, what is, do you think, the best strategy for Kyle Busch?
Yeah, I actually think I like getting away from Kyle Busch even more, maybe in single entry or 3 max, just because people tend to go with a comfortable lineup in those. And, you know, I think his ownership percentage will probably be a little higher in single entry or 3 max versus multi-entry at the same stakes. Now, obviously, you can't compare a single entry at $100 to multi-entry at $5 or whatever, but at the same stakes, I think Kyle Busch will be higher owned in single or 3 max than mass multi-entry possibilities. And that's because people tend to go with a more comfortable lineup, and Kyle Busch starting 32nd is a very safe thing. Obviously, he should move forward. So I actually like getting away from him more in single entry or 3 max, you know, maybe playing 1 Kyle Busch lineup in 3 max, maybe not playing him at all in single entry versus mass multi-entry, right? You can play 100 lineups, and if you go 30-35% on Kyle Busch, you're probably going to be underweight to the field on him, but still have plenty of exposure to him.
Okay. So this is the time where I'm going to do the plug. The model, as you mentioned, is highly accurate this week, and it is absolutely killing it. So everyone, if you aren't subscribing to RotoViz, actually, what am I talking about? If you're watching this, you're a subscriber. That was the dumbest thing ever. But if you're listening to the audio, that's right, you're not a subscriber. So you can get a 30% discount to a special NASCAR pass through the NASCAR podcast homepage, rotoviz.com/NASCAR podcast. With that pass, you get unlimited access to all of Nick's premium NASCAR content, and your subscription supports the pod. Also, if you're subscribing to the NASCAR package, then you have access to a lot of great tools and data for each race. With all of the research you are doing, you should place some NASCAR bets at mybookie.ag. They have a variety of future bets and head-to-head props for each race. As Nick mentioned, the model is very good, and it has identified a slew of props this week. So I actually just finished putting action on those right before we started recording this. I don't want to give away too much, but Denny Hamlin, check out the props. The MyBookie NASCAR futures and props are fun, and they are a great way to leverage the RotoViz subscription and supplement your NASCAR DFS action. So join now, and MyBookie will give you a 50% deposit bonus with the promo code NASCAR. So MyBookie.ag, you play, you win, and you get paid. Okay, Nick. Actually, I have a question. You had talked to me earlier off air about using props and some of the NASCAR bets to supplement your DFS action. Can you talk about that a little bit? It's kind of like a strategy that people can use.
Yeah, well, so it's funny because like when you play DFS, you're looking for different things that go into successful slates or whatever in DFS versus in betting. you're kind of looking for different things as well, because a lot of the prop bets are head to head. So you're just looking at who's going to finish higher. You're not necessarily looking at, am I getting place differential, right? So in a situation, maybe you have Kyle Busch and Denny Hamlin neck and neck, like hypothetically, let's say you had Kyle Busch and Denny Hamlin neck and neck this weekend in finishing position. That might make for an interesting prop bet if Denny Hamlin's plus 150 and Kyle Busch is minus one, whatever. Then it makes a lot of sense to bet Denny Hamlin. But in DFS, if they're neck and neck in finishing position and Kyle Busch is starting 32nd and Denny Hamlin's starting fourth, it doesn't quite make as much sense to play Hamlin unless you think he can dominate as well. So, because of the place differential aspect of it. So, it's a really cool way to get some additional exposures to drivers you maybe don't have as much exposure to because they're starting further forward or because you don't think they'll dominate or different things like that. And there's just a variety of props. There's props, like we said, head-to-head. Sometimes there's finishing position props, you know, where you finish over or under a certain position. There's obviously bets to win. So I like to maybe pick four or five props every weekend, bet some of those. And then very often I will pick maybe anywhere between three and five drivers to win, that I like, that I think have very good odds, and I'll bet them obviously in a much smaller scale because it's less likely you're going to pick the win than, you know, something that's essentially a 50-50 proposition weighted towards one side or the other. What I like to do there is maybe pick three drivers that have kind of medium to long-ish odds, you know, plus 500, 600, 800, 900, 1200 or longer. And then occasionally I'll take like one or two of the favorites. So last weekend at Bristol, I took both Kyle Busch and Kyle Larson and parlayed them with one of my prop bets so that, instead of really short odds on getting like plus 250 on Kyle Busch, all of a sudden you're parlaying it with a prop bet that you're very confident in. You can turn that plus 250 into really like essentially a plus $600 or $700 bet with a very confident prop bet. So it's just a nice way to gain exposure to some other drivers you don't necessarily get exposure to in DFS as well. And very often it makes up for my small DFS losses on the lose small, win big.
All right, let's get into it. So we have a question about dominators and mixing and matching. What percent of lineups are you looking for two dominators versus three dominators?
Yeah, Richmond is interesting because not as many cautions as, you know, a place like Bristol, which means there's often less shakeup in strategy or in lineups. So I think two dominators makes a lot of sense, especially with some of the place differential guys we have in the back, like Keselowski, Kyle Busch, Almirola, who are pretty expensive. So I think in this case, mostly two dominators with some three dominators sprinkled in. I guess there could be some situations, maybe you even just think Truex just leads like 350 laps, right? He's starting on the pole. We've seen Truex do that before, usually more at mile and a half though, but I'd say mostly two with some three dominators. And maybe if you want to sprinkle in a Truex only lineup or for dominators, I wouldn't hate it if you're multi-entering.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's an interesting question. A number of drivers are showing high variance between practice one and two based on their 10-lap averages. So Ty, Reagan, Buescher, Jones, how do you think we should interpret that information?
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, practice conditions were changing. They were a couple hours apart, and as the day goes on, the track changes, especially a track like Richmond where it's an asphalt track instead of a concrete track. But we even saw last weekend, at Bristol, the track conditions changed from the 60-degree day to the 40-degree day. So, you know, I do think there was changing track conditions. And even if you just look at practice too, the track conditions were changing. All the drivers who ran their 10-lap average early tended in general to be slower than the drivers who ran their 10-lap average later in the session. So track conditions are getting better. And it makes sense because, you know, this is a night race, so you want to be closer to the night. And, the practice session was kind of getting closer towards later in the day there. So the second practice session. So I do think we want to focus more on second practice. When I threw both first and second practice, and in the past, Richmond's also had a third practice. When I threw final practice and second to last practice into the model, only final practice long run speed popped up. So I still want to focus on final practice. For example, a guy like Denny Hamlin, he hated his car in opening practice. And, he had a very slow 10-lap average. But They made some major changes to that car at the beginning of second practice. You know, he was still junk at the beginning of second practice, made some major, major changes. And then all of a sudden he was happy with his car, and it showed in the 10 lap speed. He posted the second best 10 lap average. So that's kind of where his car ended up. And that's, you know, probably where it'll be to start the race is closer to that. So I put much more stock in the second practice. Luckily, with a lot of the top guys, they're all pretty close. I mean, you got Larson, Truex, Kyle Busch, Keselowski, you know, Elliott, they're all kind of consistently in the top eight or so in both of those practice sessions for 10 lap average. So at least with the big names, it's pretty consistent. With the smaller names, yeah, absolutely, it's a little bit tougher to gauge. And so I think I just kind of tend to default towards second practice, but then there's also other things besides practice, right? We still want to look at their track history. We want to look at their year-to-date driver rating. We want to look at, you know, their starting position and things like that. And that will help us determine their range of outcomes.
What are your thoughts on Harvick starting 10th, and what are the odds that he has to dominate?
So yeah, it's interesting because Harvick starts 10th. It is a track that is pretty difficult to pass at. And, you know, Harvick does actually have the best quality pass percentage at Richmond among active drivers over the past eight Richmond races. So that's a very good thing for him. He posted the best 20 lap average, as we talked about, and it wasn't really close. He specifically mentioned that, you know, this is the best car he's had at Richmond in years. So when he's happy, he's fast. So I do think there's a very good chance for Harvick to dominate this weekend. It's just going to, I don't think it'll be right away. You know, I think Martin Truex Jr. will lead a lot of the opening stint. If he doesn't, you know, maybe it's either Chase Elliott or Joey Logano or Denny Hamlin or Kyle Larson, who's just starting 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, or 2, 3, 4, 5, those drivers that I mentioned. Maybe one of them end up dominating. Kurt Busch is always faster. He's starting 6th. So it's not going to be easy for Harvick to get to the front, you know, even though he does have a very fast car. I think he's a good play in GPPs just because he'll rack up a lot of fastest laps. He could rack up some laps led if he does end up leading. But you know, I wouldn't go crazy on Harvick this weekend. Even though I did write him up as a good GPP play, I still think because of his $11,200 salary and all of the good drivers in front of him, and the fact that they haven't had the best pit crew this year, those are some detractions from Harvick. So the model projects him around 30% ownership. I like that exposure to Harvick, maybe 30, 35% if you want to be just a touch overweight relative to what the model thinks he's going to be owned.
Okay. I think another good question here. It says the TV guys mentioned lots of fresh tires in the back rows. What are they talking about? How does this impact DFS?
I don't think it's a huge impact, but yeah, obviously if you qualify, remember you have to start the race in your qualifying tires. So if you qualify in the back, you only did the first round of qualifying. If you qualify in the middle, you got to, you know, if you start between 13th and 24th, you also did the second round of qualifying. And if you start in the top 12, you also did the third round of qualifying. So that's just more laps on your tires. And at Richmond, a lot of tracks, they just make one qualifying lap in a session and then come off the track and hope they made it into the next round. At Richmond, sometimes you see drivers do 2, 3, occasionally even 4 laps in a round of qualifying just because it's such a short 5 mile track, and the tire wear isn't super great over that little distance that often you can get a better lap on your second lap or sometimes even your third lap. But when you start to do that over 3 sessions, all of a sudden you got 8, 9, 10 laps on your tires. It's much different than having 2 or 3 laps on your tires if you qualified near the back. I don't think it's a huge deal because, you know, I don't think a driver like Ricky Stenhouse Jr. in 12th has to worry about being passed by Kyle Busch in 30 seconds, you know, very early. It's going to be hard to pass. So I actually think it's, you know, maybe TV made a bigger deal of it than it really should be. I'm not really focused on tires too much. You know, maybe somebody like Stenhouse, it kind of sucks for him because he's starting 12th and then immediately behind him 13, 14, 15, 16, et cetera. They have fresher tires. But, you know, when you're looking at somebody like 7th on up, Erik Jones on up, you're really not too worried about those drivers getting passed by you know, a guy like maybe David Ragan in 15th or Clint Bowyer in 16th or Jimmy Johnson in 17th. Yes, they have fresher tires, but they still are going to have to get like 10 drivers forward to pass, you know, to pass Erik Jones.
Okay, so this question is one of my own. So you have a primer, a track type primer on the site, and it's great. Everyone should consult it. My question is, with the short flat tracks, there's the enhanced possibility of drivers, especially drivers near the back of the field, being lapped. Can you talk about that dynamic within the race and then what that means, like the extra difficulty of what that means for drivers?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we kind of saw the same thing last weekend in terms of Bristol. It's a half mile, just over a half mile track. There's a very real possibility of being lapped pretty quickly. At Richmond, I think it's you know, maybe a little harder for the leader to lap drivers just because, A, it's bigger than Bristol by you know, about a quarter of a mile. B, it's a short flat track, so it's a little harder to pass than it is maybe at Bristol, especially if that second line came in at Bristol. And so, you know, the slow cars will be slow cars. They'll get passed pretty quickly. You know, Harrison Rhodes will get passed pretty quickly. Reed Sorensen will get passed pretty quickly, those guys. But, you know, I do foresee, of course, Kyle Busch moving forward, Keselowski moving forward. I'm not really worried about those guys getting lapped, even with a long green flag run, because, you know, we're going to maybe have a caution in the first stage. There's still stages, and these drivers are fast. So I guess the big concern with Richmond is fewer cautions than at a place like Bristol. So there maybe is a maybe slightly more possibility we get a really long green flag run and just run that whole first stage to completion. Then you're talking, you know, Kyle Busch is already starting 32nd, maybe worked his way up to the top 15 or so. But by that time, you know, Truex has probably lapped 10 or 15 cars already. So then you're talking only 25th, 20th places on the lead lap. But I think drivers like Kyle Busch, Brad Keselowski will be okay. Maybe it's the Daniel Suarez's or the AJ Allmendinger's or some of those medium names starting back there. You maybe are a little more worried about than normal. But I don't, you know, as far as like the big names, I'm not worried. The medium names, maybe just a touch of worry, but I think it'll work itself out. It's a long race.
Mm-hmm. All right. So someone's asking a question. Is there anyone that had a good long run speed in practice, but not a good single lap speed, and that we could exploit their ownership percentage? And I guess I should add, there's the assumption here that the market is valuing 10 lap versus single lap differently. And so I'd also like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, there's a couple drivers that stand out, at least in terms of like difference between short and long run speed. I'm kind of going to flip this around. Bubba Wallace, Darrell Wallace Jr. had the second best single lap speed in final practice, but he was essentially of the drivers that made 10 lap averages, he was fourth worst. So if people are looking at Bubba's single lap speed and overvaluing that, that's a driver to get away from. Conversely, and maybe similar with Jamie McMurray. Jamie McMurray had the, you know, the third best single lap speed, and that's because these drivers made qualifying laps. You know, because practice two was very close to qualifying, they all did, not all, but many of them did their qualifying laps in practice two, and so set a very fast lap in practice two just because they, you know, they were in qualifying trim. Not every driver did, right? Harvick didn't go into qualifying trim. Chase Elliott didn't go into qualifying trim. Several drivers didn't go into qualifying trim, and in that case, you know, they'll be lower down in the single lap speed than in the 10 lap speed. So a driver like Kevin Harvick, for example, and even with Harvick, it's even better because, you know, you're seeing 27th in single lap, you're seeing 10th in 10 lap speed. But what you're really looking at is that 20 lap speed, he was number one. So, and that doesn't even show up in the statistics that NASCAR puts out publicly. Obviously Fox displayed that on TV because they get an extra set of stats for their purposes, and they displayed that on TV. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's one way to exploit, but I would kind of go the other way and say, don't play Darrell Wallace Jr. Don't necessarily play Jamie McMurray. And the other thing with Jamie McMurray, which I wrote up about in the article, is he was not happy with his car in final practice. So I don't love playing a driver who is not happy with the car. Even though he posted a very fast single lap speed, he did not post a 10 lap average. And usually, not always, but usually that's a bad sign. It could go the other way. Sometimes there's cases where you're so happy with your car in final practice that you just bring it in after three or four laps because you know it's good. The other alternative is you don't make a 10 lap run because you keep changing things every three or four laps because you're not happy with the car. In this case, Jamie McMurray was very loose in final practice.
Interesting stuff there. Did you go back to that question? Single lap versus 10 lap average. How do you think the market is at evaluating those and I guess using those to make decisions?
Yeah, it definitely varies race to race in terms of how good the market is. And that's because single lap versus 10 lap matters differently from race to race. And I think people generally look at 10 lap, but also consider single lap. I know plenty of people still do use single lap speed. And I think it's a flaw, especially at a track like Richmond, where there's not many cautions. You know, most of these are long green flag runs, so long speed's going to matter a lot more. But obviously at tracks where single lap does factor in, you know, at a track, track like Atlanta or Bristol, where, you know, if you get a late restart and tires matter so much, how are you going to do there? It's not necessarily overvalued by the public. So I think in general, single lap speed is definitely overvalued. I think at a place like Richmond, it could actually be overvalued a little bit more because there aren't as many cautions.
Interesting. Okay, we have a question about Paul Menard, and anytime we get a question, we are contractually obligated to answer it about Paul Menard. So he has bad track history. What are the chances he bucks that history?
He has bad track history. He also raced for a lesser team those past several years in Richard Childress Racing. So he does get an equipment upgrade, but I'm not in love with Paul Menard anyway. This isn't a super great track for him, as mentioned, even with the RCR history, because you compare him to his RCR teammates, Austin Dillon, Ryan Newman, nowhere near as good as those drivers were at Richmond in the past. Now you're looking this weekend, he's in better equipment, but if you look at those 10 lap speeds and you look at the drivers that made their laps later in the session, he was the slowest of all of the drivers that made their laps later in the session in 10 lap average. So I'm not a huge fan of Paul Menard this weekend. I think it's probably a mistake. It's not his best track, and he also didn't post a 10 lap average that I like, especially being later in the session.
Okay, Newman versus Bowyer.
That's a really good question. Ryan Newman model projects him to finish 13.6. Bowyer model projects him to finish 12.2. You look at their upside, for example, if you use the sim scores. I know Bowyer's sim scores actually are very good. You know, upside of 7th, and I'm kind of stalling here because I'm trying to check Ryan Newman's sim scores. But let me flip over here to Ryan Newman. 8th in terms of ceiling, and Bowyer 7th. Median projection, Bowyer definitely takes the cake over Newman. Model likes him. Sim scores like him. I like Bowyer over Newman, and Bowyer is $100 cheaper. I think this is a very good track for Clint Bowyer as well. So, really all the stats are saying Clint Bowyer versus Ryan Newman. I mean, you look at 10-lap average and final practice, it's definitely Bowyer over Newman. You look at track history. I guess Newman gets the edge in quality pass percentage, if I remember correctly, but it's pretty close. So I think overall Bowyer, especially for $100 cheaper, but there's probably going to be an ownership percentage difference. Bowyer will probably be 30% owned, ballpark 25 to 30% owned. Ryan Newman will probably be 10 to 15% owned. So in that case, I don't hate being like 25% on Bowyer and 15% on Newman, maybe the upper end of Newman's range and the lower end of Bowyer's range, because they're probably not as far apart as the market will be in GPPs.
Okay. With this being a relatively low DNF track, should we exploit ownership by fading some of the back markers and focusing on track position as opposed to place differential?
I think that's a great question, because a lot of times we say, should we exploit ownership because it's going to be a crazy race and it's unpredictable and people will be too confident. This is a different way to exploit ownership, because a lot of the ownership will be concentrated in the back, but track position is very important. It's hard to pass here. All of the stats that show up in the model essentially say the same thing, right? Quality pass percentage matters because it's so hard to pass. So if you can do it, that's awesome. Starting position matters, right? So a lot of the things are saying the same thing, the low DNF rate. So I do think it's a good weekend to avoid the Joe Dirt Chiefs, because they're not going to move forward and there's not going to be many drivers that fall out of the race. So it's a great race to avoid the Joe Dirt Chiefs. As far as the drivers like, your Kyle Busch's and your Brad Keselowski's, we talked about this, especially with Kyle Busch off the top. Yeah, I don't mind being underweight on Kyle Busch if he's not going to dominate and he's $11,400, right? I don't mind being underweight on him. That said, you still want exposure to him because it is a safe play. He could move forward, finish 5th, could move forward, win. You never know. So you definitely want your exposure to Kyle Busch, but I certainly like maybe being a little underweight on some of these drivers back here. They're great for cash game plays, and it's a great way to kind of air quote hedge your bet, is to be a little underweight on your cash game plays in GPPs. If they have a great day, then you did very well in cash. And if they have a bad day, you probably still didn't get hurt in cash because everybody's playing them in cash, and you get some leverage in GPPs. And that's kind of the way I like to place these races.
Okay. Out of these three potential dominators, can you rank Elliott, Logano, and Denny Hamlin?
Yeah, this is a really good question, because I actually think even throwing Kyle Larson right there starting 2, 3, 4, 5, it's super tough to kind of split hairs between these drivers. The model likes Elliott in terms of laps led, but not fastest laps. And I think that makes sense. He could get the jump over Truex on the initial opening start. It's unlikely, but he could. He showed pretty fast speed in both practice sessions in terms of 10 laps. So that's a good sign for Chase Elliott, just because he's starting so forward. You know, he could get out front based off of pit stops, things like that. But overall, he doesn't project well. It's not been a great track for him. And he was slower than, you know, Kyle Larson and Denny Hamlin by like 0.7 seconds or 0.7 miles an hour in 10 lap average. So I'm not going to rank him first. I'm going to rank Denny Hamlin first, just by virtue of the fact that, you know, he and Kyle Larson were essentially splitting hairs. Kyle Larson probably has a little bit higher DNF rate, although Hamlin probably has a little bit higher pit issue rate, given all the speeding penalties he seems to acquire. But I'm going to give Denny Hamlin just a slight nod, because he's a better flat track driver than Larson. I know a lot of people are on Larson this weekend. I just tend to like Hamlin just a touch more than Larson. So I'm going to go Hamlin 1, Larson 2. From there, I'm going to go Chase Elliott 3, just because of starting position over Logano 4. But I really like Logano at this track. I wrote him up, I think, the Action Network about a pick to win. And I do like him a lot at this track. So it's close between Elliott and Logano, but I'm going to give Elliott the nod just because of pit stall preference versus Logano. Not that it's a huge deal, but at a shorter track with smaller pit boxes, it maybe makes a little bit of a difference. And just because he could potentially get the initial jump over Truex. And if he has a better car than Truex on the opening stint, it's a little bit easier as well. So I'm going to go Elliott 3, Logano 4. But again, 1 and 2 of those drivers, Hamlin and Larson, are very close. 3 and 4, I think Elliott and Logano are very close.
Okay, someone's asking about Allmendinger versus Kasey Kahne.
Allmendinger versus Kahne, I think, both are fine plays. Our Allmendinger starts 33rd, Kahne starts 29th. Kahne actually showed up pretty well in a lot of the numbers that we look for, the quality pass percentage at Richmond. It was even better than some of his Hendrick teammates like Chase Elliott. So I know it's kind of inflated from being at Hendrick, but when you compare him to his Hendrick teammates, he actually was better than them in quality pass percentage at Richmond. So I do like Kahne. I like him in cash. I like him in GPPs. I'm going to go with Kasey Kahne, although Allmendinger is not a bad play as well. Pretty good at the flat tracks, but Richmond hasn't been his best track. However, he's still inside the top 25, and he's starting 33rd. So, they're pretty close. I think Kahne might draw a little bit higher ownership than Allmendinger. So if you want to exploit him in GPPs and maybe go a little closer in ownership, then that's fine. But I prefer Kahne anyway.
Okay. A two-part question. So someone says MDB sim scores are pretty good. The first question is, can you talk about him in relation to pump plays? The second question is, what do you think the odds are that I know who MDB is?
That's obviously Matt DiBenedetto there. I guess they like, you know, I guess the sim scores like Matt DiBenedetto because his 10 lap average was better than David Reagan's, AJ Allmendinger's, Daniel Suarez, Daniel Hemric, Ty Dillon, Bubba, you know, and then some of the other back markers there. So I guess that's why Matt DiBenedetto, at least in terms of the sim scores, shows up pretty well. So if you look at his sim scores, it says his ceiling 16, median 24. If you remove DNFs, if you include DNFs, not as good, 21, 30, and 39. So you do want to include DNFs, because DNFs do happen at Richmond. They're not as many. And I think it's probably overkill with DiBenedetto there, because they're comparing him to a lot of back markers who maybe start and park. So I kind of split the difference between the yes and the no DNF with Matt DiBenedetto on the sim score. So maybe a ceiling instead of 21st with DNFs and 16th with it off is 18.5 or something. Maybe his median instead of 30 versus 24, maybe it's like 25 or 26. So that's kind of what I would do with Matt DiBenedetto. You want to make sure you turn on DNFs to kind of get the fuller picture. But in this case, I think the sim scores are pulling in a lot of those super back markers, which really isn't fair to DiBenedetto. So I would give maybe more weight to the no DNF sim scores in this case. If that's the case here, you know, Matt DiBenedetto qualified 27th. I think he's a fine play, and the model only projects him at 6.6% ownership. You want to go 15% on 10 to 15% on DiBenedetto? I have no problem with that. I think it's fine. You just have to remember there's drivers starting behind him like Brad Keselowski and Kyle Busch that could be faster than him. But you know, if he's faster than Daniel Suarez and Bubba, I have no problem with that. I just don't think, you know, he's going to be a driver that drives his way through the field here at Richmond. So, also, he tends to be a better steep track driver than flat track driver. So I wouldn't go crazy on DiBenedetto, but I don't mind if you want to be a little overweight on him.
Someone has a question about negative correlation between any of the dominators. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously we think Martin Truex Jr. will dominate, being the pole sitter. And then there's probably going to be a second dominator. You know, my opinion, it's either going to be Larson or Hamlin. I don't actually think they're negatively correlated because there's 400 laps. They both could end up dominating. What I think is, like, when you get to kind of the third or fourth dominator, it's pretty unlikely that you get four dominators, or if they're lesser dominators, that they both end up dominating. So that's where we start to see negative correlation. So drivers like Chase Elliott and Joey Logano, I think, are maybe a bit negatively correlated. Maybe somebody like, if you think, you know, either Kurt Busch or Eric Jones or Brad Keselowski, right, starting way back there, or Kyle Busch, they're probably the third or fourth or fifth options. They're probably negatively correlated, you know, with Logano and Elliott as well. I do think it's Truex 1, and then Hamlin and Larson splitting hairs for 2 and 3, in my opinion, where you're probably not getting negative correlation because they're the most likely dominators, and you're probably not going to see a one dominator race. So you know, I think there's not necessarily negative correlation between those drivers.
Okay, we have a question on Larson. It says, thoughts on the speed Larson showed in final practice. The broadcast made it sound as if he was in race trim the entire time and still faster than those in qualifying trim.
I'm pretty sure he was in, you know, in qualifying trim, but I guess, you know, his fastest lap was lap 32, which was when he was in the middle of his 10 lap average there. So maybe it was a race trim lap, but he does seem pretty fast. And, you know, Denny Hamlin, same thing. His fastest lap was right there in the middle of his 10 lap average. It actually came later in his 10 lap average than in Larson's. So maybe Hamlin has the better long run car versus Larson, and Larson maybe has the better short run car. Might be a way you kind of split them up, because Larson, his was lap 32, and he started his 10 lap average on 29. So that's four laps into his 10 lap average. Denny Hamlin, his was seven laps into his 10 lap average, was his fastest. So, you know, and that ended up being their fastest laps of the whole practice session, was Larson four laps into his 10 lap average and Hamlin seven laps into his 10 lap average. So, maybe you kind of say, yeah, Larson is a super fast car and he can move forward. And that's why I think he's a very likely dominator. Same with Hamlin. I think maybe over the longer run, I prefer Hamlin. Over the shorter run, I prefer Larson. But this place does tend to play out as long runs, so maybe you prefer Denny Hamlin a little bit more to Kyle Larson.
Okay, how much stock are you putting into Kyle Busch's comments about his car at the end of final practice? It sounded like he wanted more out of his car.
Yeah, he absolutely sounded like he wanted more out of his car. That was something I what meant to mention at the top of the show when we talked about him, but forgot to. He wasn't super happy with his car. He said it was good. He said it wasn't great. They made some progress, but it wasn't where he wanted it to be. So given that he's starting 32nd, he has to drive through the field. It's tough to pass here. He wasn't necessarily the happiest with his car. Maybe that's a recipe for fading. You know, just another reason to fade Kyle Busch here, especially given his price tag and all that. So, and when I say fade, I mean underweight. You know, obviously in a single entry, I think it's good to be away from Kyle Busch. Even in three max, maybe one Kyle Busch entry top, something like that. Yeah, I think it's another good reason to be underweight on Kyle Busch. Absolutely.
Okay. We have two McDowell questions, which I really love. One, the simple version is McDowell cash game playable? The more emotional version is McDowell took a sledgehammer to my bankroll last week. Do I forgive and forget?
That's pretty funny way to put it. I think McDowell is cash game playable. He starts 24th. He's $5,200 of these, like, super Joe Dirt cheap, you know, under $5,500 drivers. He's easily the best, easily the fastest. You look at him, you know, versus Matt DiBenedetto. We talked about DiBenedetto's 10 lap average. McDowell's 10 lap average was way better than all of those drivers. And he made his early in the session. So he could be even faster maybe than somebody like Paul Menard, for example. So I actually do like McDowell this weekend. And I think you can play him in both formats. You know, after he took a sledgehammer to your bankroll last weekend, it really wasn't his fault. He got caught up in one of those incidents at Bristol that just happens, these multi-car incidents, and he was starting ninth. So that's what happens when you start inside the top 10 at Bristol. Sometimes you go backwards. If he had avoided all the issues, given how good his car was, he could have had a top five at Bristol. he just didn't avoid all the issues. That's versatile, baby. So this weekend, I feel much more comfortable with McDowell than I did last weekend. But I did have – I was just a touch overweight on McDowell last weekend as well, so I definitely feel the pain.
Okay. Are there any punts who are cash game playable?
I guess McDowell at 5,200, right? I mean, that's essentially a punt, but he's the one I think is cash game playable. I don't mind if you use DiBenedetto in GPPs. Ty Dillon, $5,600. I guess that kind of counts as a punt. I think he's cash game playable, but I think I'd rather just have McDowell at a low DNF track for 400.
All right. I think we've hit our questions. Are there any other kind of big picture things that you think people should think about, maybe in terms of like particular drivers or strategy for people creating their lineups?
Yeah. So this maybe doesn't apply as much as at Richmond as it did at a track like Bristol last weekend. But, you know, we haven't mentioned a lot of drivers. We haven't mentioned Jimmy Johnson. We haven't mentioned Austin Dillon. We haven't really mentioned Eric Almola a lot. Maybe a little bit like him and Daniel Suarez at the beginning when I said they qualified near the back and they will be popular plays. We haven't really mentioned certain drivers, right? So these drivers possibly could go under-owned. Jimmy Johnson projects at 12.5% ownership. I might like being a little overweight on Johnson just because he's Jimmy Johnson. He's pretty good. It makes more sense at Bristol, right? He was projected at like 10 or 12% ownership, and he was 11% owned. Jimmy Johnson, 11% owned at Bristol makes no sense. So just think about some of the drivers we haven't talked a lot about that could be very good. And maybe go a little over on them as well. We didn't give the Paul Menard pick of the week. Everybody always asks for who's your GPP special pick of the week. I do kind of think maybe it is Jimmy Johnson, and so that's kind of why I wanted to mention that is 12.5% ownership projection for Johnson. Get 20% exposure to him or something like that. I think it'll be fine. The Chevys have looked good this weekend. You know, Chase Elliott qualified second. Very good 10-lap average. William Byron's looked strong this weekend. I wrote him up in my article. You know, Alex Bowman right up there. So I think there's no reason to be scared of Jimmy Johnson in terms of a team perspective. And it's just a matter of, will he race better? You know, he and Clint Bowyer appear sort of neck and neck, I guess. Obviously, Bowyer appears better in the model and is cheaper. But I do think, you know, Bowyer at 30% versus Johnson at 12.5% might be too wide of a gap as well. Don't get me wrong. I really like Clint Bowyer this weekend. I think he's a very good play. But Johnson is just a driver that kind of I keep coming back to. Like, everybody dislikes him for some reason these days. And, yeah, I think 11.5%, 12.5% is too low on him.
Okay. Nick, anything else we should talk? It's Saturday. What, you know, the race is tonight. What are you doing till then? And then – what are you planning on doing tomorrow with your day?
So actually, I volunteer at a homeless youth shelter here in Nevada. So I'm going to go make food for them after I get showered up and changed and all that. And, you know, I'm not playing this weekend. I'm taking this weekend off from DFS, but I'll be back next weekend to play for sure. And then Sunday, what am I going to do Sunday? I actually have no idea. I'll probably hang out with my wife. That would be a nice thing to do.
All right. That's going to do it for this RotoViz Live edition of On the Daily. For Nick Ifan on Twitter at RotoDoc, I'm Matt Friedman, Matt F. The Oracle. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you for listening to On the Daily, the RotoViz Daily Fantasy Sports Podcast powered by RotoViz Radio. And special thanks to Randy E. Aguabo for the introduction. Please review the podcast on iTunes under the established RotoViz Radio feed. Contact us via email onthedailydfs@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter @onthedailydfs.